actually the first trike that I ever did was, I was like 9 or 10, something like that. And that was in school.
Hallo und willkommen zurück zum Podcast Bin ich süß-sauer? Ich bin Song Un und ich spreche mit queeren asiatischen Menschen in Deutschland über unsere Leben, Herausforderungen und Träumen. Es ist wieder sehr, sehr lange her, dass meine letzte Episode erschienen ist und es tut mir leid, aber es gab Gründe, wie immer. Nämlich, ich habe meine Doktorarbeit endlich abgegeben, zum einen, aber auch zum anderen habe ich auch die Doktorarbeit jetzt verteidigt. Und endlich habe ich auch wiederum Zeit, wieder mit meiner Gäste zu treffen und ihren Lebensgeschichte zuzuhören. Nee, ich freue mich riesig, denn die Person, die gerade gegenüber mir sitzt, ist nicht nur eine sehr, sehr spannende Gast, sondern auch eine gute Freundin von mir. Und die Folge heute wird auf Englisch sein. Deshalb werde ich gleich ins Englische switchen. Ich hoffe, dass ihr auch dem Gespräch trotzdem folgen könnt. Und jetzt passiert quasi ein Switchen. Hi, this is Song Un and welcome back to my podcast, Bin ich süß-sauer or Am I sweet-sauer? In my podcast, I'm speaking to queer Asian people living in Germany and we are also listening to their life stories, their challenges, but also their dreams. Today's guest is not only a very stunning person, but also a very good friend of mine, Pramona. Hi, Pramona.
Hi, so good. It's so nice to be here.
I'm so happy to be able to talk to you in my podcast.
I'm very, very, very grateful that you gave me this opportunity. And I must already start by saying congratulations, Dr. Almost Dr. Song Un. It's a very big deal for me that I witnessed you finish this long, long race. So I want to acknowledge it here.
Thank you so much, Pramona. And I also have to return your congratulations because you also just finished your PhD.
Yeah.
Huge congratulations on that.
Thank you very much, Song Un. Thank you. It means a lot to me.
How do you feel about it?
I think right now I feel quite relieved. Mm-hmm. The exhaustion was very immediate, mm-hmm. and it was also somehow not letting me rest. You know, sometimes when you're too exhausted that you can't sleep. But now I think the exhaustion is kind of softening up and entering my body. So I'm being able to kind of go into a little bit of rest time, and I'm hoping that you are also doing the same.
Yeah. It took me about 2 months until I could finally, take some good rest from all the works. But now we are doing fine, I guess.
Yes.
First off, would you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Pramona. I use she, her pronouns. I am an artist, an activist, an academic, and a curator. These are the things that are quote unquote my professional description mm-hmm. words. However, I'm obviously not confined to these identities because these are just my professional identities. And I grew up in a city called Calcutta in the eastern part of India. And then I went to Delhi, where I lived for 10 years, did my university, my undergrad, etc. And then I found my way to Berlin. And I've lived here since October 2016. So it's been a while in the city. And my relationship to the city is something to behold. It's constantly changing. It's sometimes extremely trash, sometimes very healthy. It's good, yeah. And I'm really sort of humbled to be able to, at this point of time, say, as a part of my introduction itself, that I have been able to be blessed by particular kinds of people around me and communities that can hold me and every part of me, not just the academic, activist, you know, artist, whatever, whoever is, whatever part of me is productive for a capitalism type of parts, but like me as me. And one of those people is you, Sungun.
Aww.
Yeah, very much so. I believe this.
I mean, I'm also very blessed to have you in my life as a friend. And it was just happy coincidence that we ran into each other because it was 2015, I guess. And back then I just started with my PhD program.
Yes.
And you were doing your MPhil.
I was doing my MPhil.
Yes. And our advisors at two different universities, they organized an student conference, I guess.
Correct.
Some exchange.
Workshop. Yeah, a workshop. That's
it. Yeah, that's for students from University of Cologne and University from JNU.
JNU, Jawaharlal Nehru University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you came to Cologne and we had about a week of time.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a good amount of time together.
Yeah.
And I think I don't really remember well.
I remember, okay. Actually, because I was thinking about it on my way here. I mean, of course, you know, we have known each other now for a while, right? 7 years now. And I remember the first time, like, so we were hanging around in the same space, which was at the archive, the theater archive of the University of Cologne, which was Schloss
Wahn.
Correct. I even remember that. So Schloss Wahn. And I think we were on our way back to town from Schloss Wahn. And there was a bunch of us. We were all standing around at the S-Bahn station waiting for the S-Bahn. And considering me and the person that I am and always will probably be, I was kind of giving you some sort of lecture. It was some sort of rant or some sort of like extremely intense lecture, like in the middle of a fucking S-Bahn. Oh, sorry, my bad. In the middle of an S-Bahn station. It was just like something about like, these are the stakes of like the student protests and you have to understand the political frontier. You know, I was proselytizing like a little activist, right? And you were like, you know, listening very clearly, very closely, because you told me about your sister after that. And I thought in that moment, standing at Schloss Wahn S-Bahn station with a bunch of other exchange students, all of us just a bit like disoriented and jet lagged. In that moment, you gave me like some really intimate information about yourself. And I found that to be really touching. It was it was my first genuine interaction in Germany. And I was just there for a very little amount of time. But still, somehow I don't know, for various reasons, I was not very comfortable. And this was why I was like, wow, okay, that was that was really special. So I remember that very strongly. And then, of course, it went from strength to strength and we started hanging out and whatever, whatever. The rest is, as we say, history.
Yeah, I am, to be honest, I don't remember the specific moment, but I can't do follow the old me in this sense, because my sister used to be an activist as well and very politically engaged for a long time. And I sometimes do see my sister in you and also vice versa. So yeah,
nice.
I think that sure was the point that I also noticed at that time. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, that's very nice to hear.
Soul sister.
Oh, so sweet. Oh my God.
Would you like to tell us more about you? So how was your childhood? What were the things that made you happy? What memories do you have about your childhood?
I was a child that biked a lot. I was growing up in a very particular kind of setup. My grandparents had migrated from what would eventually become Bangladesh in 1971. They migrated to what became India in 1947. So They were both scientists. This is my mum's mum and dad. They're both scientists, and they had this kind of particular household which didn't ever have a lock on its front door. Mm. And you could basically come to that house and you would get, you know, food and a place to sleep. And they had, because they were like the two people in like massive families, like post-partition migrant slash refugee families. They were the two people who had, you know, reasonably stable income, you know, with their scientist jobs. They basically sort of became a kind of what we would call in Bangla, in my mother tongue, Bonoshpati, like the biggest tree in the forest, around whom people would come and people would sit under their shadow, you know, to get a moment of rest. So I grew up in this house, you know, it was just open and everybody, people were constantly coming and going, lots of kids, etc. And with a particular kind of impulse of communal living, always sharing things, because you have to. And yeah, it was both very, very good and very, very intense. And I was a child who was growing up in those kinds of setups, and I remember riding my bicycle very, very fast all around the neighborhood and beyond. As a way to sometimes cope with the fact that in these kinds of setups, which from the outside seems like really healthy and you know, so different from the individualistic problems of Western society, etc. These can also be spaces in which, you know, like personal boundaries, etc., can be very porous, and people can really, you know, be in each other's business a lot. And especially as kids, you are expected to kind of, you know, make a lot of space for others, you know, etc. So I used to, as a kid, I used to bike a lot, and I used to draw and paint. Art was a very, very salient part of my ways of working through my emotions. I at least showed the emotions through art practice from a very, very young age. And that kept me sane, quote unquote, happy, and balanced. That was me as a child.
I'm just fascinated about the fact that your grandparents were the biggest tree, in literal sense, somehow. But why did they do that? Have you ever asked them about it?
So the thing is that the partition of the subcontinent, which is connected to the British colonizers leaving, it is an event that has touched almost all of us in the subcontinent, at least in the particular parts such as the northwest and the east. And it is, you know, it has been definitive in both the history, like the quote unquote big history, and the small histories of us as people. And I think I have had multiple conversations with my grandparents while they were alive, about, you know, what happened, because, you know, it's a very difficult thing for people to talk about, because the partition was a very, you know, it was a very bloody process. There was a massive refugee crisis, massive number of people, dead. Because there was, you know, it was also connected to like a severe moment in intercommunal violence between Hindus and Muslims specifically, because the partition was also happening along those lines, Pakistan belonging to the Muslims of South Asia, India belonging to the quote unquote Hindus, but on paper secular, whatever, that's a different story. But because of that, there was actually a massive death toll. Mm-hmm. And this is like death toll. We are talking in terms of pogroms. So people killing their neighbors and mm-hmm. things like that, right? And then having to kind of live on with that. So a huge amount of trauma. Mm. And I think the fact that they escaped that under whatever circumstances, my grandfather came in 1943, if I'm not mistaken, but the tensions had already gotten there. Mm. My grandmother left her position in Dhaka University, where she was a researcher, to come to Calcutta mm. In 1947. That's the year of partition. They did their best, I would say. I'm not sure. I'm no judge of that. But I would say that they did their best to somehow find a way to self-medicate this mm-hmm. trauma through familial cohesion. Mm. I was not alive to see my granny's mom, but she used to also live with us. My older sister, mm-hmm. she has interacted with her. Mm-hmm. So our great-grandmother. And these are people who have seen and witnessed particular kinds of trauma, which was for the longest time actively suppressed mm-hmm. by governments, people, because these are traumatic memories. Mm-hmm. And the self-medication was, in essence, just like the community having to just like come together, stick together. That was the only way to, I suppose, even deal with the trauma. I mean, there's always that one point of time as an Indian kid or like a South Asian kid, I suppose, there is a moment where somebody in your life talks to you about colonialism. Mm. Someone at some particular age. And then they immediately start talking about partition. And then you realize that, oh, this is perhaps the reason why my grandfather was actually crying, looking at something at the television. Mm. This is the thing. And I think this is the reason why they became the kind of massively caregiving people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm not sure if that answers the question, because it's a very complicated question to answer. But I would say that the kind of almost unbelievable amounts of like cohesion or like expectation of like family cohesion, let's mm-hmm. call it that, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, your story just remind me of a book that I recently read from Jan Hambjell Federer. Mm-hmm. He's a German author, mm-hmm. also a friend of mine.
Ah!
And his father belongs to the Chinese minority in Indonesia. And he also experienced similar kind of trauma. Mm. So Yannick deals with the simple question, where are you from, mm-hmm. in his newest book. Mm-hmm. And it's also a story about how complicated the question actually is, or how complicated the answer is actually is, and how much of it is due to the history, as you just beautifully told us.
Yeah.
And also the other thing that came to my mind is even after their death, the house where your grandparents used to live is still a place that is defined by their presence.
Yes, very much so. And this is always been the place where like the big parties, the big, you know, celebrations have taken place, and it remains that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that house in Golf Green, that's the name of the Keats, it's very special, and the whole Keats also somehow knows that. Mm-hmm. Because they all have seen us, and they all know my grandfather was that, you know, crazy doctor who used to go around like, you know, dressed in his like towel or like his bathrobe, because he was this kind of slightly eccentric character. He would like run out and like, you know, if somebody's like picking flowers from the garden without his permission, he would run out in his bathrobe and be like, what are you doing? So he is also like this very colorful character in mm-hmm. the Keats. And my grandmother, equally colorful, but like very like very kind of, how do you call it, like very balanced. You know, my grandfather, extremely like, you know, insanely always screaming and shouting and just like lots of drama. My grandmother, like very balanced and measured and this kind of extremely elegant woman. she one of my favorite things to remember and also share is that, so my granny is a very special person. She was a physicist. And this is from
this is
a woman of a generation where a lot of women did not even go to school. And she did, and she was working with the scientist who's called S.N. Bose, the person whose name is in the boson of the Higgs boson particle, the God particle. So the boson particle, which is a subatomic particle, is named after S.N. Bose because he was one of the people who discovered it. And my granny was his student.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's a massive like shadow of a giant, really a tree, the biggest tree, right? And my granny, I believe, is like my single greatest role model. Yeah, because I have always seen her, you know, since I was a kid. I have been a science fiction nut for a very, very long time in my life. I have written and like, you know, obsessed over science fiction. And my granny always felt like something out of a science fiction story because she was this kind of incredible person and with this incredible life as a particle physicist from that era. And the thing that I was trying to tell you before was that one of the funnest memories from my childhood is like she was a, this very elegant lady who would have these very elegant tea parties with her girlfriends, you know. So it's like this bunch of when I was a kid, like these were like middle-aged to higher women, all wearing these very soft like white saris, which are, you know, connected, you know, affectively, emotionally, you connect that to grannies, you know, this kind of very soft cotton saris, no starch. It just also smells a little bit like granny like home. Yeah. All of these women in these white saris coming to our, you know, to this big house in Golf Green where my granny would like, you know, serve them tea and snacks and they would like sit around and gossip. And then you realize that they were like, you know, mathematicians, physicists, you know, statisticians. Like they are basically the creme de la creme of like, you know, women intellectuals in science at that point of time. And perhaps some of the like path breakers, you know, like basically they are, you know, perhaps the first or one of the first people to, you know, like be, you know, head of the department of the mathematics department in Calcutta University or something like that. This is the level of their achievement. And I got access to them as like, you know, a grandkid, you know. So it is like seriously amazing and incredible. This is my, I would say, my life's connection to magic is my granny.
I just imagine this tea party like a meeting of goddess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're like small child.
I'm a tiny child. Exactly.
To this meeting and just adoring them.
Exactly. And then, you know, I think like after my granny passed, this was in 2018, my granny passed. And when I went home after in 2019, I had this incredible experience where I was home, I was in Calcutta, and we got a phone call. My mom got a phone call from one of these ladies saying that, hey, I want to come to your house and I want a photograph of Shondha, which is the name of my granny, for my office. So I want to come. So my mom is like, why don't you just come for lunch and we can, you know, my younger daughter is here, you know, she's also doing a PhD. And I was like, oh fuck, ma, why do you have to say, okay, anyway. So she was like, yeah, okay, I'll come for lunch. So there's this very frail like white sari clad woman who can't actually walk without assistance, right? She comes to our house and she's, you know, kind of saying these like lovely stories and it's just all fun and games and like, you know, oh, old woman saying stories about the old days. And then my mom says, okay, just wait, you guys wait. I'm going to make some lunch. I'm going to like prepare lunch. And Ma leaves the room and then she looks at me and all this, you know, like soft, granny shit is gone. She looks at me and says, tell me about your PhD. Immediately, right? And I was like, whoa, shit. Bitch means business, okay? So I was like, yeah, well, okay, this is what I work on, etc. And I'm like fumbling. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel so like,
You're on holidays, but no.
Exactly. I was so like chill about the whole thing. And then I was like, okay, this is like one of the greatest minds in South Asia. Mm-hmm. And just because she can't walk without assistance, Pramona, don't think that she will not judge the fuck out of you. You know, so I was just like, yeah, okay, so this is what my methodology is. And I was just like, completely. And then she was like, interesting. Okay, she was being very, she was like, interesting. Wow, okay, so this is an interest. So she was being like, you know, I guess kind. And then I was like, are you working on anything right now? And she's like, yeah, I actually just wrote a paper.
Wow.
And I was like, on what? And she said, well, actually, it's a rejoinder to Einstein's theory of general relativity. I was like, sorry? She was like, yeah, you know the theory of general relativity, right? I was like, equals mc square? And she's like, yeah, that's correct. But do you know what it means? I was like, no, I don't think so. And she says, okay, I'll tell you in two lines. I was like, okay. And this old lady sitting on my bed says, space has mass, and therefore space is curved. And I look at her, and I'm almost on the verge of crying, because I'm like, I don't think anybody has said something so simple, so elegant, and so profound to me ever in my life. And like, I can sense that I am in the room with pure excellence and like kind of, you know, like the most amazing, one of the most amazing female role models I could ever have. Mm. And I'm just like, please just, I looked at her, I was like, that was one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. Next time I'm in Calcutta, can I just come and like hang out with you? And she said, yes, if I'm alive.
Bam.
Yeah, I was like, wow, she was the best. So like, she also, like, my granny was surrounded by these women. And my granny is exactly also like that, very funny, extremely no nonsense. Mm-hmm. Extremely no nonsense, takes no shit. And yeah, she's my greatest inspiration. But she also, in my head, I think she's still somehow something out of a science fiction movie situation, story, yeah.
It's a while during our conversation, but I have to smile because you use the word keys sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it's very, very Berlin, right? In Berlin, people say that in German, keys for neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I can't help but like smiling because I could just hear that you've been here in Berlin for like 6 years now, right?
Yeah.
And also, I really love the picture of you sitting with a friend of your grandma who's suddenly the science goddess.
Suddenly.
But also, as I understand it, it's not just about publishing the paper for, I don't know, for whatever. It's not about this academic business, what people say, but it's about life devoted to the knowledge. Which is very rare, don't you think so? Because we are now trained in thinking in that way, doing that way, and also being competitive in the way. But it's also something that I miss from, also from my family. My family, I don't have any academic background, but my grandparents, they loved texts. Mm-hmm. And they adored people who could read and write well. Mm. And sometimes I miss that.
Yeah.
This is this pure
pleasure,
this the love of knowledge, the love of something better.
Agreed.
Not about just ranking, not about getting yet another stipend, not about that.
I couldn't say it any better. I think it's like, you know, there is very much the promise that knowledge contains the seed to liberation. Mm. You know, and whatever may be your understanding of liberation, my understanding of liberation is radical, progressive, leftist, anarchist, whatever, you know, but whatever it may be, at some point of time, you are communicated this thing that knowledge will set you free. And then you realize that in order for you to get to this knowledge, you have to somehow have this really horrible, extractive, colonial, self-abusive relationship to gaining knowledge. I would say it's an insult to the idea of knowledge itself because it does not center curiosity.
Mm.
Like, you know, you're leading with your curious self, the self that, you know, opened your eyes when you were a child, mm-hmm. you know, the ways in which you sought. Children naturally are gravitating towards pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
That is how we are when we are kids. We gravitate towards the thing that makes us feel the best. Always, we choose that. And then it's, you know, it is the unfortunate and purely man-made and supremely unnecessary situation. Particular things are considered to be knowledge. And particular things are mm-hmm. not. Mm-hmm. And that is directly related to colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is actually knowledge. And this is, you know, when we were speaking earlier today, it's like, you know, there are particular ways of speaking academically, mm-hmm. which are then legible academically for mm-hmm. other academics. I mean, bro, that I mean, there's like another whole world outside, right? Which these, you know, which as academics, we are being constantly messaged to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever we speak from a place which is connected to those worlds, to, you know, communities, our people or whatever, you know, like our cultures, etc., we are really badly disciplined.
And also, I mean, English is not my first language and German neither.
Mm.
And we are both doing we both done our PhD in a foreign country.
Correct.
Sometimes I ask myself if I've done better in Korea, in my first language. Do you also have the moment where you think...
Difficult question to answer. I think linguistically, I mean, I still think mostly in Bangla.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very close relationship to my mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
I feel a lot of pride about it. It's like, this is the deep, dark secret that Pramuna keeps, that she can somehow sometimes be a bit of a Bengali nationalist. No, that's not true. I just have a lot of love for my mother tongue. And I only realized it because I've spent so much time away from it.
Mm.
And every time I hear it, I perk up immediately because it's like, oh, it's such a beautiful language. So in terms of, like, linguistically speaking, I would say that I crave that familiarity. But in terms of whether I would be doing better
mm-hmm.
in terms of academics, this is a much harder question to mm-hmm. answer because as you know, but maybe your, audience doesn't, or your listeners don't. I come out of a particular moment in the higher education system in India where the change of government in India from whatever centrist right to ultra right, Hindu supremacist, Hindu fascism was happening. And as you know, you were probably there also. Mm-hmm. When my university itself was in protest against mm-hmm. that, because my university back in Delhi was very much in the crosshairs of the fascist government, being actively, you know, students being hounded, students being arrested, students being killed, etc. So I don't actually think it is even an option for me to say that I would have done better
mm-hmm.
back home.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is back home?
Mm-hmm.
It's a big question mark. Yeah, I mean, much as I understand the very specific and very intense challenges of being a foreigner, a person of color,
mm-hmm.
A queer person of color
mm-hmm.
in German academics, from the global south. Like these are big, you know, things that we have to deal with.
Mm.
Structural issues, direct violence, structural violence, all of that. Much as I know that and have paid prices for that, I am not in a place where I can say that back home would have been better.
Mm. You just briefly mentioned the situation in India. Mm. What I found really impressive about you is that you have been politically very active in India, in Delhi.
Mm.
As I met you, as I visited Delhi in 2016.
16, I think, yeah.
Yeah. But also after you moved to Berlin, you somehow, you're also not only doing your PhD, but also political works. Do you remember the moment where you thought it is necessary in back in Delhi or Calcutta and in Berlin?
Thank you for that question. So, I have been an activist, I guess, quote unquote, within social movements and political movements since I was a kid. I was growing up in Calcutta, which was basically a red city. It was in a communist ruled state of West Bengal. Because India has a federalist structure, each of the states can have their own political governance, right? So I grew up in the fag end of the communist rule. So there was a strong sort of leftist culture of unionism. You know, the party functionaries and the party structure was very strong, and that also was like oppressive, as we realized, while I was growing up, the party had become kind of the fascists, right? But you know, obviously we have to be very clear about this, that leftism is not the party only. You know, left politics is done by many people who are not part of institutions like the party. This is a political point that I'm going to have to make. So I was a part of various different kinds of political movements.
But as a child already.
As a kid, yeah. Mm-hmm. As a kid.
How come?
Because, you know, that's why I mentioned the context of the city.
Mm-hmm.
I think the city itself lends, because it was a leftist city, it was, there was just like, there was no way that as a kid you would grow up without witnessing a strike or without witnessing a big demo and without, you know, your parents like kind of taking you in. However, later I realized, and now I realize, that there were lots of people from my generation who never went to any of these. It was in my head alone that I would think that the city presented itself to all other kids, but no, I think the city presented itself to me as that, and I would be politically naive to think that this was the way everybody grew up, because if that was the case, then fascism would not be so close home, I would think. So I was basically then involved, say, in anti-privatization movements. That was, I would say, some of my first forays into like political organizing, because there was a moment in late communism in West Bengal where the communist government was making a lot of these really bad deals with like foreign direct investors, because India had opened up its economy, etc., neoliberal economy, and a lot of peasants their lands were being taken away to be made into SEZ, special economic zones, which were basically ecologically horrible, politically horrible, economically horrible. Like it would be like massive chunks of land, really good land near the sea, given away to Honda, say, for example. So that's their space. They make their factory. They have their people living there. They have their own security system. So it's very...
It just sounds like colonialism.
Exactly is colonial. It's absolutely colonialism. It's neocolonial. And the thing is that the special economic zone, the SEZ model of development, is a very strong... part of neocolonialism, which is a part of capitalism in general, like late capitalism in general. And it's always kind of given this thing that no, actually we are doing a good thing for these countries. Like China is full of SEZs, basically, you know. The poor third world countries, you know, we are giving them employment. They can come and work in the Honda factory, for example, you know. However, it would highly be possible that the jobs in the SEZ for the local community would be, you know, jobs of janitors, security professional, like, you know, things like that. So not actually, you know, jobs which are quote unquote dignified. So anyway, I was very young when like massive number of SEZs were being floated in and around Calcutta. And I got involved because I just could not really figure out what was going on. It was also, I was very young.
How old were you?
I was maybe 13 years old. Yeah. But actually the first strike that I ever did was, I was like 9 or 10, something like that. And that was in school.
Who striked against what?
I called the strike.
Uh-huh.
So basically what happened was the school had decided that instead to make some point system, some point system where our houses would be awarded points, like in Harry Potter, right? Okay. It was basically like the school had tried to be Harry Potter, like Hogwarts. And it was very strange already. And then they started getting worse because it would be, they would like deduct points because girls wore nail paint or had shorter skirts. So it very quickly went to like, you know, disciplining women's bodies. And like, we were like, I was so mad. Okay. Like super mad, extremely, extremely mad. I remember being very mad. And I was like, hey, guys, like, it was just like a bunch of us in our class. We're like, hey, guys, listen, why don't we do something? Why don't we do a protest? And people are like, oh, good idea. What do we do in a protest? It's like, okay, so we need somebody to bring a music system. And somebody was like, yeah, okay, I can bring my sister's music system. Like, all right, so we will come earlier than generally tomorrow. We're going to enter the classroom. We are going to lock it from the inside so that nobody can come into the class. And we are going to blast music throughout the day. Is everybody on board with this idea? Yes, we are all on board. So that was our first strike. And it was, I think we got suspended from school, all of us, for like a month or so, because like the teachers were totally lost. They could not imagine what was going on. I was like, what is happening? And they were like standing outside, just like banging on the door. I mean, so it was not really, neither was it a strike nor a protest, because we had not told what we were protesting against. We had not actually informed anybody. We did not have any real demands, you know, which we communicated. It was just like, let's do a protest. Somebody bring a music system. And we are just going to have a massive party. And that's what happened. But that was, I would say, in my head, that was my first political strike. Because it was, I mean, they did take away the rule. Because they could imagine that we were becoming ungovernable completely. And we were like getting more and more badly behaved as students. And they were like, all right, we get it.
How did your parents react to that?
My mom used to teach in the same school.
Oh.
Right. So she would sometimes get calls from the high school, you know, she was in the primary school, saying that, oh, you know, your daughter has done this. And she would be like, please call my husband. Please call my husband. I have to take a class. And I think my dad really couldn't give a fuck. He was like, oh, okay. Oh. He would just make like vague noises. And I have never actually been kind of chastised as such by my parents for any political action, except the lines in the sand are drawn sometimes.
What is it? Sorry.
It's a proverb, like, you know, there are some boundaries that do not get crossed, I suppose. And I was crossing all the boundaries. And one of them was my queer identity. That was very difficult for them to deal with. And I suppose it took them a lot of, I mean, honestly, I don't know whether what they feel about it now, because I have made some boundaries about not wanting to talk to them about it, because it's not my job to parent my parents, simply.
When did you realize that you are different?
In terms of my sexual orientation, very early. I did not know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I also therefore did not think it was something different. I just kind of knew that this, I would say I knew my desire.
Mm.
That's it.
Which was
that I liked women.
Mm.
And I think I was very aware of one thing, which was that the representations of romance around me were not working for me.
Mm.
This was an actual realization. The desire one was not real and actual. It was just something that was just a part of my inner being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it was also quite healthily coming out. And, you know, like, you know, the fact that my first kiss was like when I was maybe 9 years old with it was amazing. Anyway, so it was so sweet. But, you know, the fact that it's an identity and that it's different, you know, the kind of the, for it to become a part of like a conscious expression only happened after I realized this thing that, wait, all this stuff around me.
Like TV shows, yeah, movies.
Yeah, TV shows, movies, also the way people are acting with each other. Like, you know, we were, you know, kind of running headfast into puberty, and I was in a mixed school, and like I was a bit like, oh, I'm expected to like now have like a boyfriend, and like, you know, and none of that was working for me. And that's when I realized, 1 second, this has got something to do with disciplining people's happiness.
Mm-hmm.
I remember these exact words, like, this has got something, somebody's trying to stop some other people from being happy. And I wonder why that's happening. And it took me a while to then realize what's going on, etc. Actually, it took me quite a while. I mean, I only started doing like activism, which would also involve like being a part of some sort of an LGBTQI scene, etc. When I went to Delhi, which was in 2007, I was 17 years old. And like had my like actual like relationships, you know, with women and stuff like that. So with my parents, I think there was it's hard to actually, you know, speak about it. So I probably won't. But that was the boundary that could not be crossed, because for me, it's not a boundary. It's about myself. And I crossed it, and that's when like all the deep inspiration that I got from my parents in terms of and my grandparents in terms of like their relationship to politics, you know, them being able to encourage both me and my sister to kind of be critical about status quo. My dad was also, still is, like somebody who politically educates me about many things. Specifically leftist thought and leftist action. That was the moment when it took a very deep beating. And I was like, ugh, that's really disappointing. Over many, many years, I think I have come to view my parents as also humans with faults, which is very mature of me. And it's not my job to be that mature, because I'm not the parent, I'm the child. But it's survival.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I can congratulate myself for having survived that moment, which was very hard for me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have the impression that parents, maybe they have guess about their children that they might be queer or gay or lesbian or trans, and they don't want the clarity.
Yeah.
They just want to be able to just fantasize, I don't know, about grandchildren or whatever they think of, being their child or being their children, heteronormative.
Yeah.
And sometimes that was exactly the situation where my parents were angry about me that I came out to them.
Mm.
They confront me with the question, why on earth are you telling us this? if it is so burdening to you? Why do we have to know that? And it was a shock to me because I took a shitload of burden from them.
Yeah.
Not that they wanted to, want me to do, yeah. But we went through a lot of things as family, like mm-hmm. poverty, mm-hmm. also family crisis. And for me, it was clear that even if I was a child, that we as family take this burden together.
Yeah.
So it was at that moment for me, the like a moment of betrayal.
Yeah.
You know, like, wait a minute, I did all the work unasked. Mm-hmm. And now you're saying that I have to keep it to myself, mm-hmm. just, you yeah. know, carrying the burden just by myself.
Absolutely.
No.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I hear you. Like, that it was a really strong sense of betrayal. And I think, like, it's also because, you know, I'm bi and I am, you know, even within queer spaces, mm-hmm. I am confronted with mm-hmm. weirdness. Mm-hmm. Right. There's a lot of this kind of erasure. There is a lot of suspicion. I think it's like just the suspicion, like it's like, oh, you know, something is like, this person's dangerous. There's something dangerous about bi people, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, it's very like, you know, they are trying to access best of both worlds or whatever. Like, you know, there's a lot of this weirdness and like insecurities around mm-hmm. bisexuality. And my parents were like, I don't know, they projected a lot of their confusion onto me mm-hmm. because they just did not want to process anything. And in that moment, which can be a very human moment, I would be actually still shocked, but like, I suppose better off if it was seen as exactly that, a moment of failure by mm-hmm. everybody. But no, it was not. They were able, you know, they weaponized it and like they said mean things to me and they denied me my humanity and they denied me my sense of self and they were wrong.
Hmm.
And it is not my job to forgive them. But unfortunately, it had to become my job for me to take those particular steps that I needed to take to, you know, maintain some level of distance, protect myself, you know, etc. But at least I made a good decision, I think, like a boundary-based decision at that point. As an 18-year-old, I salute myself that I could do that at that point of time. I don't know how or where I got the strength. I basically told myself, okay, you are not going to ever educate or even attempt to educate your parents. That's not your fucking job.
Mm.
They will educate themselves.
Mm.
You will just live your own life.
Mm.
And so I let go of that burden also.
Mm-hmm. So you started a new chapter of your life in Delhi?
That was not the moment. That was right before MA. This was like they found out, quote unquote. This was right before I did my MA. This was not at all the beginning of the new chapter.
Mm. Then when was it?
I suppose a new chapter in a not a great way. This was this moment, which was a very rough moment also because my parents not being okay with who I am and my then partner she leaving me immediately at the same time when I told her that okay this is happening and I'd probably have to leave home etc.
Mm-hmm.
And she just couldn't handle it and she was like okay whatever. So it was very strange. This was my first proper serious experience of like a really bad mental illness. And I was diagnosed clinically. I went on antidepressants for the first time in my life. And I was doing all of that on my own and like without a lot of support. My best friend Bedatri was around and she was the main support. So this was, in a way, it was a particularly important chapter because, you know, I mean, at this point of time, now sitting here in my life, you know, I have had a lot of time and a lot of, I have had the opportunity to kind of get enough diagnoses in my life to know that I have, you know, complex PTSD, which is something that is chronic and I have to live with it every day. Lots of trauma, but you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. So, and now I'm way more aware of, you know, what that means and why my mind is like the way it is or whatever, and why my relationship to the world seems so different. It's, you know, it's not just that I am queer, it's not just that I'm like, you know, brown in a white country or whatever, you know, it's I just have a different brain, and that would mean that I have a different way of connecting to this world, but that would also mean that I am probably connected to other worlds. And I like thinking more about those other worlds than about this particular world in which we live, the material reality, which can be really, really unkind to us. So yeah, that was not exactly, you know, a good new chapter, but it was, you know, really a strong, definitive moment in my life, which taught me a lot of things about myself, which would come back as lessons again and again.
Yeah. Mm. And having experienced that, dealing with all the challenges all by yourself in a foreign city where you're not home to, right? I think it's incredibly strong of you that you decided once again to come to yet another country, which is Germany. So how did you decide to come to Berlin?
Again, not a fully voluntary decision. I was here for a year initially on a fellowship, basically. I had won a fellowship, and this was in 2016, but the university back home, which was JNU, where you went, it was currently going through, at that point of time, like massive student struggle, student protests, massive police action, students, you know, disappearing from campus, student leaders being arrested, you know, being roughed up in jail, etc. It was an insane situation, basically. I got this in 2016 itself. And I remember coming here thinking 1 year of just a break from all this stuff. And then when I went back home in January, by that time, the whole administration had turned very strongly fascist. And basically, for various weird and odd and reasons that are banal, I was not allowed to register. And so I was kind of stuck going like, oh shit, am I being like thrown out of university now? What will I do?
But you had a great grade in your MPhil. You also had a work experience as curator at Delhi, very successful.
None of that mattered. It was just a very, very strange experience. It was also a very traumatic experience. I have to acknowledge that. And I only realized that many years later when I was living in Berlin already. So basically, finish that story, they refused to register me back. I went around the whole from pillow to post trying to figure out how to get back. And then realized that nobody, quote unquote, had any power because it was like a fascist system where the vice chancellor was the, you know, who was like a basically like a little tiny little fascist. He was kind of somehow you know, he had the power to throw me out or whatever on the basis of some report that he expected me to write for him on the basis of the 1 year that I've spent in Berlin. Like, tell us, what do you do? What did you do? And what do you even work on? And I was like, you have my MPhil in your system. Read it. You know, but I also realized that it was, you know, they were not, they were doing this to a lot of people. It was essentially like, you know, fascism is banal. It's very important that we, it's not spectacular. It's a kind of, it can be spectacular and it can be like kind of ritualistic, you know, exceptional violence, but it is everyday sort of making sure, you know, particular people who are not aligned to this new idea of whatever a university and whatever knowledge is, just kind of little, you know, cuts in the corner, cut the corners and just let them go. So I was in this weird situation where I did not know what to do with my life. And I came back here and I figured out a way to stay on and start my PhD here. But it was a very, very, very traumatic experience. I told you earlier, I was telling you that I have unfortunately faced many instances, almost in every university and higher education space, of being almost on the verge of being thrown out or leaving. And I've always felt like, why is this constantly happening to me? And I would like to just, you know, kind of come back to this conversation. It's not only the fact that I am just generally, you know, bad with authority. I don't even know what that would mean. What does it mean to be good with authority? You know, what kind of people are good with authority? One wonders. I don't know. No, it's not just about being bad with authority. It's not just about being like always doing political work that is somehow like against the values or whatever of the university or the institution, or not being productive and or whatever. You know, it's not just about that. I think it's just that I find institutions, especially academic institutions, to be really cruel places. I am a neurodivergent person. I have, for the longest time, had to mask that by being ultra smart and being ultra articulate and trying super fucking hard to always try to, I don't know, prove my humanity, prove my smartness and prove my productivity and all of that. And I can do all of it, but I don't want to. And I have always felt these places to be places of just pressure and dreams go there to die and people are not happy. And I just, I've always just been so angry. And I've always been somehow messaged to be like, yeah, it's good that you're angry, you know, kind of write an essay about it, you know, channelize it, you know, use some, you know, philosophers to, you know, make your argument better. I was like, no, I don't actually have an argument. My argument is fuck you. You know, that's my argument. So I think it's also something that I have only been able to acknowledge late, many years later, maybe now only, that the reason why I have always had this kind of, like, I've had a long academic career, but it's always been kind of always on the verge of being thrown out or like something dramatic is happening. And people are like, why are you going through, why does it always feel like you're going through something? It's because I'm fucking neurodivergent. That's why. I'm literally always going through something because like my brain doesn't like being like overworked and made to prove its worth all the time. And my question is, why are you all okay? You know, how? Teach me. Maybe I would also be, you know, super well adjusted. And I don't know. It would be my dream, honestly, Sungun, to be so well adjusted that I never question authority. But I don't think that's going to happen in this lifetime. Yeah.
So, are you telling me that after 5 years of doing PhD and completing it, are you thinking about leaving academia? How people say that in dramatic way, like I'm leaving academia.
Yeah, I'm dramatically leaving academia. I had a recent conversation with my comrade, maybe you know her, Mikey, who is Mikito, based out of Hamburg. She's a comic book writer, zine maker, leftist intellectual, activist, and a comrade of mine. And she's also my birthday twin. Just shout out to Mikey. So if you're listening, Mikey, I love you. So I had a recent conversation with Mikey, who was in Berlin and talking at a Roma Pride Day event on intersectionality. And we were discussing this, that not all knowledge is created in academia at all. Knowledge production and knowledge dissemination, the two things that academia apparently does, is constantly happening in non-academic spaces. In very situated and very life-affirming, survival-centered ways, you know, where somebody's teaching you how to live because they were taught that. It's proper actual dissemination, preservation, creation of knowledge. And those of us who have had the fortune / misfortune of being in academia, we know that academia is actually involved in the industry that is making sure that those kinds of knowledges are not known as knowledges. That only the things that are defined as such by academics and written in particular categories of engagement would be then called, deemed as knowledge. You know,
what Foucault says with discourse.
That's right? It, exactly. You know, it's like, you know, something that has to be declared as knowledge in order for it to be so. Sorry, honey, that's just not the way life works. And I know for a fact that I will not stop either making or disseminating or preserving knowledge if I leave academia, you know? So the fact that even the decision to leave academia seems so dramatic, because it is, you know, it's been made into like, you know, are you sure? Do you really, you know? But it seems like I'm not actually leaving anything. You know, I'm not actually leaving anything of any consequence. What I'm leaving is a bunch of procedures. You know, I'm leaving procedural, like loyalty to procedure over loyalty to substance, as I was saying earlier. So yeah, I also think that as long as academia remains so deeply married to capitalist productivity and to burnout culture and to the fetish of intelligence and the fetish of merit as, like, you know, these natural things that some people have, like, you know, and like, you can also get there if you read enough books. Read 100 books in 100 days, you know. As long as academia is like that, I know for a fact that it's not healthy for me to be in it. And considering the number of times I've tried to leave and then come back and leave and then come back, clearly I am able to do something, or, you know, mask myself in some ways that I keep coming back. So clearly I will never leave academia permanently and I will keep coming back. But I think it's really sort of important for me right now to take a break from it, because I think I'm also aging.
What? How old are you, Pramona?
I'm 32. No, but by aging, I'm not saying like in terms of like linearity of time, but I think I'm aging in terms of the fact that I don't like masking anymore. You know, like there is this concept, and it's not a concept, it's also a lived reality, called crip time, which is coming from a disability studies and a disability rights space, where time doesn't work linear progressive way, right? For people with disability experiences, disabled people. And one of the things that happens because of crip time is, like, you know, the masking as like a coping mechanism only works to a certain extent in your life. And then you realize that, oh my God, this people-pleasing stuff is actually really, like, it's exhausted me to some extent. And I can't, the mask is constantly slipping. And my mask has been slipping for a while and I have somehow like kept going. Mm-hmm. And I think now the mask is also like, it slipped, it fell and it looked at me and I said, Pramana, stop it. So I think that's what I meant when I said I'm aging. I think my masks are really, really down. And I want to explore this world with, you know, all my dysfunctionalities on display.
Mm. Do you have any project or plan that you are eager to share with us?
As a part of my artistic and activist work, I am really interested and I do a lot of world building exercises because I'm so interested in science fiction. And like, I feel like science fiction and speculative fiction is a very good, very life affirming, decolonial activist impulse for me. Mm-hmm. So as a part of that, I am, as I said, leaving academia because I've got a new job. So my new job, it's not a very new job, it's an oldish job, which not a lot of people know about. And so I'm coming out. So I captain a spaceship called the spaceship Beben. So the mm-hmm. German word, yeah, for quake, Beben. So it's a spaceship that was co-created in 2020 mm-hmm. by myself and a bunch of my comrades. And they do a lot of different kinds of work. Some of them are artists, some of them are writers, they are mothers, they are cooks, they are geographers. We have many activists on board, we have translators, many different kinds of people. Mm-hmm. It's a tight crew and we are always like, we're hanging out together, giving each other a lot of care, etc. And so the Beben is something I just wanted to tell everybody about because it's a very, it's a deep space exploration vehicle. And what it does is that it time travels and it tries to find ex-colonial worlds out mm. there. Mm-hmm. Right? Because we believe that another world is not only possible, you know, which is the slogan from the 1968, another world is possible, right? We believe that the another world is there. Mm-hmm. It's right here. Mm-hmm. And we can actually, if we can imagine it, we can make it happen. Because everything that you see around you, everything, it was in somebody's imagination, right? And then it got manifested. So this is just something that I want to tell everybody. So what we do is sometimes we make radio shows. We sometimes have exhibitions, etc., where we share some of our sound work, mm. which we have done together. And hopefully, because we recently found some funding to be able to make some Beben work possible in 2023, we are all, it's also like an entirely Flintak U crew. Mm. Says men are not involved or invited. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the Beben because I wanted to also say hi to all my crew. If
and
they
you're
are
the captain.
I'm the captain and I'm the chef. All of us have like double shifts. And so we travel together and what we do is through different kinds of practices of worlding, world building, we center, you know, the different oppressions that our bodies go through in this material reality. And we try to see what around us is available for us to make those oppressions go away or feel better. So, you know, actually, this place that we are sitting in next to Langazee, that was one of the spaces where the Beben, when it came to Earth, when we visited Earth last time in 2022, and we recruited some people, mm-hmm. we landed in the Langazee. And there was a recruitment drive, which we did, which involved like really long interviews, actually. Mm-hmm. Like long interviews. So there's an open call. If you want to be a part of the crew, you have to write us a letter and then we ask you to come to, you know, a watery place and then everybody goes swimming together. And then we have a picnic and then we have these long interviews where we talk about, you know, space travel, you know, what do you have previous experience? Do you, what do you expect from the ship, you know? So, because I really think that science fiction and speculative fiction is, you know, I'm trained as a historian, you know, academically. So there is a very strong fetish of the past that I've had to deal with. Science fiction is the thing that has kept me going because it's a balm, because it's about, you know, you actively taking on the work of thinking of the future.
Mm.
Not in a way where it's like, you know, historically we always think about it, it's inevitable. This happened and then this happens. Obviously, climate change is going to lead to obviously. How do you know it's so obvious? Are you from the future? No. You know, I understand that, you know. So there has to be some sort of curiosity and some sort of imagination that is involved in order for you to actually do both activist work and do historical work, mm-hmm. where you look at the future as a place of play. Of course, we are fucked. We understand we live in a dying planet. But why are we not being able to imagine? Like, it's easier for us to imagine the end of the world and not the end of capitalism. It's very strange, you know? So for many, many, especially for oppressed communities, imagination has been a very strong political frontier, which we have escaped to sometimes, which we have used sometimes, you know? This is the place where a lot of our politics happens in various ways. So it's only fair that science fiction is our language.
Mm.
It's our genre. It's mm-hmm. not some white dudes who are thinking about like war of the, you know, whatever. I'm a big H.G. Wells fan, but like, you know, science fiction was like really stolen to become a part of the story of like progress and industrial revolution. But science fiction is actually our language because we need to be able to imagine our survival. Our communities are under so much pressure of death. So many of us are having to live under the shadow of the death of comrades, death of people, our communities. So it's really important that we get to imagine our futures mm-hmm. in ways that are, you know, good.
Mm-hmm. Sounds all very exciting, but how can I, as cisgender man, I'm not daring to take on the ship,
yeah.
But is there any way to experience your journey, like
yes.
In which form?
Yes. So basically, I can share with you the website on which we share some of our dispatches,
mm-hmm.
and it's also a project in which I'm a co-curator. It's called the Project Kal, and it's a transoceanic South Asian platform which has started by some of my comrades, and I work very closely with this. So we made a radio show,
mm-hmm.
and there were many things, many episodes of the radio show. I was the RJ, and one of the episodes is Babe, like flight logs from the ship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm very slowly inching towards taking myself seriously as an art practitioner. It's going to be a lifelong process, but I'm enjoying it, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm also very excited about your yet another chapter.
Yet another.
After finishing your PhD.
Ooh.
Is there anything that you want to share, or is there any topic that you want to speak about?
I would just like to put it out there, and it's, I mean, because you made space for this, but I would just like to put it out there that we live in a very, very imperfect world, and a very deeply unkind world, and we are constantly being bombarded with imagery of our own kind dying constantly. And I know it's really, really difficult for us to handle it. And I just wanted to communicate that we can keep each other safe, and we can actually protect each other's softness and hold each other's tenderness, and very importantly, all fascists die. Fascism is a small blip in history. It's not the entire history. So we will outlive it. There is no question. No matter how much we think that this is not going to end, Heck, oh, for sure it's going to end. Yeah, and maybe we'll be there to witness it and dance in the ashes of fascism and capitalism. Oh, what a fantastic image. Oh my gosh. Oh, that made me very happy.
All right. I think we came to the end of the conversation today.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pramona, for taking your time.
Thank you,
and sharing your thoughts and your life stories with us.
Thank you, Sungun, for doing this, for having me here. And I wanted to tell you that you are a very important part of my life. And it's really fantastic to have you there, have you here, and to be able to talk to you in this way. Mm. Thank you.
Love you, Pramona.
Love you, Sungun.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. I'll come back with another conversation next month. Then stay safe and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.